Blog Talk Radio.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. I hope, indeed I pray, that we shall not be found unworthy of our victory if after toil and tribulation it is granted to us. For the rest, we have to gain the victory. That is our task.
Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools and we will finish the job.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the East Anglians EDL radio show, broadcasting live on blogtalkradio.com. And tonight, we got once again a great co-host of the show is Vlad Tepes, a great blogger. Vlad, welcome. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me back. Thank you for having me back. It's always great to be here. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be invited back.
Yeah, it's a great, as I say, it's always great to have you back here anyway, Vlad. But tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we've also got a great guest, haven't we, Vlad? And we've got a great guest this evening.
Yeah, let's build the suspense up a bit. I'm really excited about this. As far as I know, he's never done an interview. Like, I think this may be his first time doing this kind of an interview. And, yeah, so it's great. He's one of the most influential and knowledgeable people about this entire thing. And I might add, he's one of the first people to notice this issue and this problem and start very publicly broadcasting and blogging about it and researching it, especially the year. He's an American writer and blogger, but has discussed the European issue with such great knowledge that most people do think he's actually a European site. And it's very interesting. It's just going to be great to get a chance to find out why one of the earliest people in this were sufficiently motivated and concerned about what they saw going on around them that they would fundamentally change their life to do this. Because, as you know, once you start talking about this issue, you just can't live quite the same anymore. I mean, Geert Wilders is the extreme, but everybody who does this to an extent has to change how they live a little bit, because the danger is just that real.
It takes your life over, I would say, actually, Rabbi. It does, actually. It's probably the same as you and the same as myself. Once we start started studying and looking into this cult, we realized how deep and evil it was. And it takes your life over with the things that's been coming out over the years and what we've seen before us. And it seems the depravity, it seems to get worse as it's been going along over the last 20 years or so. It's just sort of deteriorated. Well, it's got worse in its ambitions, and it's become more brazen as of late, isn't it? I would say as well.
Well, it certainly has. Actually, with your permission, I'd like to raise a few points that I've been thinking about since the show last week that I think really need to be addressed. Because I think a big part of the problem that we're facing is that people just accept point blank a bunch of things we're told over and over and over again. And we just hear it by repetition. And, of course, it's complete nonsense. And even those of us on our side of the equation repeat the enemy's sort of memes, the enemy's kind of, little concepts for things. And as a consequence of which, we defeat ourselves, even when we talk about it, in our own terms. Because they aren't our own terms. They're the enemy's terms, And there's so many examples of this. Like, I really should carry a pencil and paper around, like more organized people do. So I'm just going to be able to, once I happen to remember at the moment. But let's begin with one that really, really bites. And that's the concept of multiculturalism. And I actually maintain that nobody believes in it. I think it's an oxymoron, for one thing, or an oxymoron. Nobody really believes in multiculturalism. But the people that actually claim they do, the ones that think they do, are so arrogant and so full of hubris. And why do I say that? Because what they really mean when they say multiculturalism is everybody thinks like they do, and if it looks like they don't, it's because they really do. Let me explain. If you were to say, for instance, that there was a different cultural group that didn't believe in ownership of property in the way that, let's say, people from European roots do, right? So people from European background believe that if you go out and you work for some work, and then you get paid based on what it's agreed that you'll get paid for the work that you did, and then you buy a thing, that thing is yours. And if somebody else takes it from you without permission, that's what we call theft, and it's what we call a crime. But let's say there's another culture that doesn't believe that. Let's say we'll make up a name for it. We'll call them, tinkers. And let's say that they were to come, these tinkers believed that people who work for a living were actually kind of idiots and suckers, and that no one has a right to property, and they just come and take it, right? Multiculturalists would tell you that it would be racist to actually point out that that's what this group really believes. In other words, multiculturalists believe that we're actually all the same. You follow? They don't really believe in it at all.
Yeah.
Now, let's take this to the realm of medicine, for example, or food, right? if you go to a restaurant in England, you would expect, or in Canada, certainly United States, basically anywhere in Europe, but let's say, for the sake of argument, Canada, United States, and England, because that's who's going to be represented on this show. If you go to a restaurant, you have reasonable expectations of a couple of things, that the food that you're going to eat has been handled in a certain manner, right? It's been prepared according to certain standards of health, right? That it has been, that the plates and so on and the kitchen is kept clean in a certain manner, that the food hasn't been allowed to sit around rotting in the sun, that only certain kinds of foods are used and other food kinds of foods are not used, right? Like nobody drinks camel urine for medicine in our culture. You follow?
Yes.
So, okay, now that's a very culturally specific thing. The very concept of germs, the very concept of biology and germs comes from the ancient Greeks. That the ancient Greeks invented the science which became the background of our general thinking. Our culture all comes from that. Like we invent science. It initially was called natural philosophy, which was a branch of philosophy that was invented by the ancient Greeks. And all that we know about biology and about pathogens, about viruses and bacteria and so on, all of these things come from one culture, which was so effective and so useful that we adopted, especially if you look at the Renaissance, at Renaissance and post-Renaissance Europe, these ideas were so powerful and so useful that anybody who used them flourished because they got less people got sick and more cures and better medicine and better foods were developed and better methods for storing foods. All of this came from the ancient Greeks, but there are other cultures in the world that don't have roots in ancient Greek thought, right? So they might, if they were to open a restaurant and not use those standards of cleanliness or those standards of hygiene that protect us all from various pathogens and so on, well, we'd be called a racist if we said, look, these Somali restaurants are not obeying these things. So we don't enforce our laws on them. We just pretend that it's, you know what I mean? Like there's no such thing. You and furthermore, no matter how you shuffle the deck, you can't have multiple sets of laws for different people based on their cultural or ethnic or racial or religious background operating in the same jurisdiction. You just can't do it. You've got to have the same rules operating for everybody, or else you're going to, you know, wars. There's an organization that I both like and simultaneously dislike, and that's STRAT for Strategic Forecasting, which is it's a private think tank that does geopolitical intelligence, right? It's like the CIA for civilians, kind of. And there's things about them I really like and things about them that I don't, but they, in one of the books that the head of Stratford author, he said that wars happen not because groups of people are different. They happen because groups of people who are different are forced to mix, right? That's what the root cause of war is. And you can see it. You can see it happening today that leftist governments, for reasons that, you know, actually, I shouldn't say for whatever reasons, I'm sure at some level we all know. It's just that it's so depressing and so disheartening and so sickening that it's difficult to actually give voice to it. It's easier to go, oh, my God, why are they doing this, right? Because then we don't have to face the horrible reality that it seems like these governments are out to obliterate the traditional culture and peoples of these countries. I mean, because there's no other explanation that's consistent with what they do. And then we've got backbenchers in England that have been coming out and saying, yeah, that's what we've been doing. Here's the documents. And then every couple of months, another backbencher or another retired member of parliament or another senior civil servant comes out with more evidence and more proof that certainly in England that was the case. But it's just too difficult for us to accept. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is multiculturalism. Look, If people really believed in it, right? Let me ask you some questions. What does a religious Muslim believe or claim to believe about what happens to them if they're killed while trying to fight to spread Islam, to make Islam dominant? What happens?
Well, they'll go straight to Jannah. They'll get their 72 virgins and all the delights that they wanted because they've martyred themselves. That's the greatest honor they can achieve is to martyr themselves, isn't it? That's what they say.
So, they say they want this or they don't want this to happen?
Sorry?
I know it sounds like an obvious question, but I'm going to ask you again. Do Muslims want this? Do they want this experience, like this martyrdom and the 72 virgins? Is it something they believe they want?
I believe so. Forgive
me. The questions, these aren't trick questions. They're very straightforward. It's just that I'm trying to get to a point. And in order to get to that point, I have to look at some things that seem obvious. So
yes.
I think you and I agree that religious Muslims, I'm not talking about cultural Muslims because, you know, I don't care what night of the year they have a special family dinner on and call it whatever, I don't care. But in terms of the religious Muslims, they are claiming, at least, and they're doing so very loudly, Anjem Chowdhury and his lot, and, you know, all of, you go to YouTube and you look at countless thousands of videos of preaching and individuals who want to martyr themselves, they say, well, their greatest hope, even the Muslim Brotherhood's actual slogan is our, you know, our guest today can probably get it exact, quote it word for word, but it's something like our greatest aim is to die in the way of you know, the pirate Mohammed's imaginary friend, right? Okay.
Yes.
This brings me back. It sounds like I've gone far afield, but I really haven't. My point is, if anybody actually believed in multiculturalism, what would be the kindest thing to do to Muslims? Yeah, you don't need to answer that because we're both going to go to jail if you do. But the point...
I think we know...
The point is, nobody really believes in multiculturalism. The people that say they do actually are being patronizing to religious Muslims by saying, no, they don't really. No, they don't. No. No, they don't really. They believe what we believe, that life is like all the stuff about the afterlife are kids' stories, and they just say that stuff because they're disadvantaged or they're poor or they feel like they haven't got enough free stuff from the government or there's not enough socialism. No, they don't. Multiculturalists are the most condescending and patriotic. At least those of us that listen to what Muslims say and believe it, at least we have the decency and the respect for them, at least to that limited extent, to go, yeah, you know what? You really believe that. I get it. This is what you say. We believe you mean it. And you know what? Like I say, if you really believe in multiculturalism, then people would be giving them what they want and not what it is that we think that we think they're really just like us. I mean, anyway, so that's multi. Now back to the issue of respect. So somebody a while ago, I forget exactly who it was, but somebody coined a term to refer to the really religious Muslims that you see walking around on Western city streets in like the night, what I call the Wee Willy Winky outfit, the nightgown and the little, you know, the nightcap and the, you know, the beard, all the wee. Wee Willy Winky was too young for a beard, but you know what I mean. Like he's just got that. He's holding a candle, I think, that these guys are holding, I don't know, C4 or something. But you sort of see these guys, why, and you know perfectly well they're doing it as a provocation, just like those public prayers. It's not really about devotion to their deity. It's a provocation. And wearing those clothes.
Provocation.
Okay. So somebody coined the term mustards for these guys. What did they mean by that? Well, it was a contraction of two words, Muslim retards, right? So you put those two words together, Muslim retard, you get mustard. Oh, well, that's kind of a natural fit. And I thought, you know, first of all, I think it's, if you look back at World War II, even before, if you went to a movie, you'd see all kinds of stuff mocking and ridiculing the SS and the Germans. Before you'd see the movie, you'd see shorts on it. Why? Because it's important for us to these are our enemy. These are people who have sworn to destroy our way of life, to destroy our legal system. These are people who in organized gangs are waging war on us in ways that unfortunately we're too complacent to understand, but including and not limited to the mass rape of our little girls. And you know what I mean? And the coordinated, by the way, and this brings me to another point that I want to get to later, and that is how can you say that government agents and news and media people who knew about these coordinated assaults on the little girls of the UK, and frankly it's happening in Canada and US, everywhere else, but the cover-up is still effective here. But the people who are covering this stuff up, how are they not complicit in a crime of unparalleled magnitude or an act complicit with the enemy in an act of war in exactly the same way that they would come and arrest you or arrest me if we knew about an act of pending terrorism and did nothing to inform the public?
I was just going along with your train of thought there, what you're saying there, Vlad. No, you can't carry on because I'm sort of nodding my head and I'll just make a little statement.
If I don't get this kind of stuff out, I get a nosebleed. Okay, the fact is, the fact is, if you knew about some horrible crime that was going to take place, and you thought, well, I'm not going to tell about it because it might interfere with community relations, like the police might not like my brother or my friend or my neighbor after they find out what he's planning to do. They would arrest you, and they would try you very publicly, and they would convict you, and they would jail you for all sorts of complicity and for all kinds of crimes for which I don't remember or know the actual technical legal term. Yet we have members of the government at all levels, you know, municipal, federal, all the way up, various members of the bureaucracy, elected members, and members of the media who've had meetings knowing full well what's taking place and deliberately deceived the British people in order to keep, and frankly, it's happening now in Canada and the States, deliberately to preserve the narrative of multiculturalism, meaning that everybody is really the same. Again, going back to what I said a few minutes ago, multiculturalism is the arrogant, hubris-filled myth that there are really no different cultures, that everybody's just like us. And to say that a different culture is actually different and point at what it actually and demonstrably is called racism. That is so patently insane. Yet, but back to the point, there are people who should be in jail for what they have not said because they are complicit by not telling, by not acting in a way that could have prevented. You know, we now have people speaking out. We have various people in the police services and various other, bureaucrats that are saying, well, you know what, it looks like we've got a problem in every city in England. Oh, yeah. How long have you known that? And why have you said nothing? Even the BBC is now coming out and saying, after a 10-minute, very watered-down episode, a segment about this mass nationwide raping of children, raping and forced. You know what it is? It's slavery. And only, by the way, only one – I'm going to come back to this, but only one news service, I think it was the Mirror, actually had the decency, I won't say courage, actually had the raw basic decency to call it what it was. Everybody else uses nice terms like grooming. Oh, yes, these kids are being groomed, but what's wrong with that? Grooming, well, those kids should be groomed. Why aren't their parents grooming them? These kids should be groomed. This isn't grooming. This is white slavery. This is what Islam has done since it started. It is part of the basic credo of Islam to take white people as slaves, especially white girls as sex slaves. This is what they do. And it is not racist to say so, because A, Islam is not a race, and B, we're talking about one of the central features of that culture, and pointing it out is real multiculturalism.
Well, what can I say to that? You are so right what you say. It's been covering it up for such a long time. And anybody that's been associated with not sort of speaking out again, they are complacent. They should be held accountable for their actions. Do you know what, Vlad? I've always said that. These people should be held accountable. They should be, remember who they are, because there'll be a time when they're going to be accountable for what they've done and what they've let happen into our nations. As you say, the rape of our children up and down the length and depth of our country, and being silent in case they think it could cause, they'd be classed as racist because of a certain case that made them look in that way, which was going back quite a few years, the Stephen Lawrence case, which most of us was up speed on that. But that happened, and they become very complacent in the way that they handled themselves with future things. And this is what we're seeing. But the trouble is, who is suffering? It's the young children of the country, up and down the country, not just this country, but many other countries. We're seeing there's an epidemic of raping in Sweden, Norway. I mean, this is going to, as you say, and that is the core thing of the Islamic culture. Is what we're seeing. You are bang on.
The Quran says over and over again that a Muslim male can have as many women as his right hand may possess. Now, to decrypt that for the Quranically challenged, and wouldn't it be, I'd hope and pray to be one of those again someday. But for those that are Quranically challenged, All the women the right hand can possess means war booty. That any women you can, that's not a Muslim woman, that you can just go take them. They're your property. They're not to be looked at as worthy of personhood. They're simply something. They're like basically the way any pirate would look at any merchandise that belonged to somebody else. It's technically, if you can get it, it's yours. Right, and that's what the Quran says about non-Muslim women. And again, even calling it rape is short of the mark. You see, and some detractors, people who object to the stuff I'm saying, there's a bunch of very common logical fallacies. They say, well, rape isn't limited to Muslims. Why, why are you singling them out? Look, what about all the white people that do rape? Let me explain what one of the very fundamental and important distinctions is between these actions and the actions of the indigenous people. For one thing, let's just assume that it was the same, which it most certainly is not. But let's just assume that it is. If I have six kids in my family and one of them is a criminal or a rapist or a pervert, does that mean that I have to let the rapists, criminals, and perverts of everybody else's family come live in my house? No, it means I have a problem to deal with and I deal with it. The other five kids are okay. One of them has to be sequestered or punished or dealt with in some way so that he can do no harm. But that because one of my, I mean, it's a complete and absurd logical fallacy that because one of the kids in my house happens to be a criminal, that somehow justifies allowing hundreds of millions of other criminals, hundreds of thousands of them, to come and live in the house. Yeah, well, one of my kids is, so why shouldn't I let them all in? That's the kind of argument that I hear quite often from people who wish to argue with me. But the fact is, it is not the same. There's a difference between that which is done for a political motive and a crime. It's one thing if somebody mugs you because they want to take 40 pounds off of you for drugs or for whatever reason they want to take your money because they're thieves. It's quite another thing when there's an organized effort with a political goal in mind in order to take – they're using robbery as a way of disenfranchising you, of destroying your criminal justice system, of dehumanizing or belittling your people and making themselves – establishing themselves as the force in the area. That's a different thing. That's what you call war. And it has to be treated as such, and it has to be treated as such. So back to these terms of endearment, such as mustard. I was thinking about a kind of another logical extension of that the other day. We have somehow built some decrepit moron, some horrible human being, that wraps himself in explosives with the purpose of killing other people, right? And then we let them call him a martyr, right? We let them call that person a martyr, which is it's the farthest possible thing from a martyr, and we call them a suicide bomber. Well, I was thinking a more appropriate term would be Pop-Tard. And I'll tell you why.
Say again.
Say again.
What was that?
I thought that might catch a few people off guard. I think Pop-Tard is a much better a term for this, and I'll tell you why. These people deserve neither. They absolutely don't deserve respect, and they certainly aren't martyrs. A martyr is somebody that sacrifices themselves for the betterment of others, which brings me to another topic that I think is really interesting. I read an article last week that talked about the significance of, like, a politician gives speeches all the time, and this article I read claimed that there was very little significance in the actual speech that a politician gives. But the real significance, the real message, is in the timing and the place and the nature of the speech. For example, one of Obama's very first speeches was at a university in Cairo, where he made absolutely sure that the Muslim Brotherhood was present and that Al-Azhar University was present, which is the central Islamic, Sunni Islamic, it's like the main authority of Sunni Islam for the world. It's like Princeton and Harvard all rolled into one, yeah? And Oxford.
Yeah, yeah.
So he made sure that the Al-Azhar people were at the speech. So he said a bunch of more or less potboiler stuff about Islam. But this article was making the claim that because he chose to give this speech in Cairo, at that university, with those people present, that what he was really saying is, we are sorry for American power, and we're going to reduce it, which he's done. And he's continuing to do, by the way. If you saw today's news about unilateral nuclear disarmament in the States, it's like the movie Octopussy, except, it's real. And the fact, and he's also saying that we're going to abandon all of our former allies like England and Israel. And why? What evidence do I have for that? Well, his first act as president was to send back the bust of Churchill, which your prime minister at the time had offered to let him keep. And he did it in such a way that even the government of England was quite shocked that he would so brusquely return that bust because he didn't want his office. Why? Because he hates England. He thinks of England as a colonial power. Okay.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Why?
Yeah.
So why am I bringing all this up? Well, for two reasons. When we get our guest on in a couple of minutes, I want to do something I normally don't do, and that's talk about U.S. politics. I normally try to avoid it for a lot of reasons and a lot of good reasons. But that line, the lines have all been crossed. That U.S.
Yes.
politics is now very much about the empowerment of Islam and the disenfranchisation of Western secular liberal democracy. But it's also because of what the Pope did. And the Pope did something really extraordinary. He made saints out of 800 Christians whose 800 people at once. I think it's the biggest canonization in the history of the Catholic Church. That's significant, right? But what did they do to be a saint? Well, there's no miracles attributed to them as far as I know. It wasn't like Mother Teresa where there was, you know, she did an entire lifetime of good works. These people were canonized for one reason, and that's Muslims tried to forcibly convert them to Islam. They would not be converted, and so they were all killed. They were killed in not what Muslims call defending the faith, which means, you know, killing people if they refuse to be subjected to it. They were killed for actually defending their own right to their own freedom of conscience. And the fact that the Pope did that may speak volumes about what the church may be more cognizant of what's taking place in the world right now than we'd like to give them credit for. And I think this deserves a little bit of respect.
Yeah, well, that did stand when I say that and I heard about that. It was a bit of an elation. I thought, about time, you know, that we see something like this in the world, you know. 800 people who died for their faith, they refused to give up their faith, who they was and that. And I think it was, for me, it was a great act. You say it spoke volumes of what's going on in the world. So I think that was, I say it jumped out at me, and I sort of, it's a bit of elation. I thought, oh, my goodness me. And that took how long to do, though? To
800 years. 800 years. You know what, though? The timing couldn't have been better. I have to say I have a lot of new and continued respect for the Catholic Church. I think that was a significant move. And I don't know. We'll just have to keep watching. Hey, does it look like our guest is on the line?
Oh yeah, yes. I think that could be our guest.
So I could go. I could go on like that all day. And I think
that's fantastic.
You know, it's,
what can I say? But I never get tired. You know, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you listen to Vlad Tepes, and I've got to admit, I'm sort of when Vlad's talking, I want to listen. Because, you know, he's got so much. And he said he had to get it out because he's going to make his nose bleed otherwise. And I'll tell you what, I hope everybody's enjoying. I'd say Vlad Tepes, he's a great blogger, an awesome blogger. And ladies and gentlemen, tonight, as I say, we've got a great guest. I don't know if you'd like to introduce our guest, Brad, or shall I go ahead?
I do. I'm going to introduce him. I'm very excited to do so. First of all, I got to just pimp my site for a second, because when you find out who's on, it just won't matter anymore. But my site is vladtepesblog.com. Vlad, V-L-A-D, Tepes, T-E-P-E-S, blog, blog.com. And I hope you all check in often and comment on stuff, because I think, you know, sometimes I just post a lot of news stories. So what, right? But the really interesting thing is I really enjoy the insights and observations of people who come to read the site. And there's some pretty extraordinary people that write there. So I hope you all come check it out. Ladies and gentlemen, we have on the line one of the most interesting and thoughtful and intelligent people of the counter-jihad. He goes by Baron Baudissé. And I'm going to find out exactly, well, you know, one thing I've never asked him is who that is and why that name. But he runs the venerable site, Gates of Vienna. And, you know, you know, I don't know whether or not Gates knows this or not, but I actually started blogging because of two or three sites. It was religionofpeace.com and gatesofvienna.com and Jihad Watch and one or two others. And I thought, these people are so courageous, and they're what the work they're doing is so important. I initially started my site for one reason only, to hoping that anybody who liked the style of the way I presented things could direct them to these people's sites. Like, the idea was I wanted to sort of just be a kind of a, you know, an elbow joint in plumbing terms, and get people to redirect over to Gates of Vienna and a couple of other sites, because I thought these the work they did and the insights they had were so important. And picking up the slack for the mainstream media the way they do, legacy media, I think, is actually a better term. You know, anyway, Baron, are you there?
Wait,
I think I have to hit. There's a hole.
There we go. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Fantastic, yes.
Coming through.
Welcome.
Hello,
yeah,
Jeff. Are you Jeff?
Yes, I am, Baron Bodici. It's a great honor and a great privilege to have you on the show this evening.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So we have so much territory to cover. I'm really happy you could make it. Thank you very much for coming on. This is really great.
Does this count as being interviewed by the vampire?
I guess it does. I guess it does. So, yeah, I know, and the sun's still up, so this is, you know, this is quite difficult for me. Let's see. Where do I begin with this? Normally, I start, as I was saying in my rant earlier, I try to avoid U.S. politics because, it's, you know, you don't want to get caught up in that, right? It ends up being gossipy, and it ends up distracting you, and before you know it, you've been pulled away from your main mission, and you can get so bogged down in the minutiae of who said what and who did what, you know. But the problem is, we now see that the U.S. government, it looks like we're in truly historic times, and there appears to be a relationship between the issues that we do cover, namely Islamic influence or the leftist Islamic alliance. It looks to be so profound and so unsubtle. It's not just a sort of a confluence of streams, you know. It looks like a very planned and detailed thing with enormous impact, and I know that this is something that you understand better than most, being also that you're in the United States. Could you just take a few minutes and try to explain to people who may not be aware of some of the scandals that are going on? Can you point for them what some of the current president's scandals are that he's involved in, and how they relate to, say, well, I don't know, Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, there's so many of them, it's hard to get started on them. Diana West, you had her on here last week. She covered it very well. Of course, there have been a couple of new ones since then. Some of them are domestic, like the IRS doing its selective repression of political groups, Tea Party groups. That's purely domestic politics. But the Muslim Brotherhood stuff should be of concern to everybody, because the infiltration of our government by the Muslim Brotherhood is extensive, and it's been very successful, and most Americans aren't aware of it. They see talking heads on television and their Muslim Brotherhood, and they don't know that, and they don't know that Muslim Brotherhood representatives have the ear of their congressman or the Secretary of Defense or the, you know, the Homeland Security, the Pentagon. Their Muslim Brotherhood advisors spread all through the Pentagon. And this is well known inside the Beltway, but the average American doesn't know about it. And you mentioned the motto of the Muslim Brotherhood, which I have here in front of me. Allah is our objective. The Prophet is our leader. The Quran is our law. Jihad is our way. Dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope.
Well, that pretty much covers it.
And these are the same people that issued that Holy Land Foundation memo, the explanatory memorandum back in 1991, that talked about bringing down the United States government from within. And it's explicit. And the same memorandum lists the groups that were affiliated with it, and they're the same groups that are still that still appear on CNN to explain how oppressed Muslims are and explain why Islam is the religion of peace. And they also advise the FBI, they advise Homeland Security, they advise the Pentagon, the same groups that are declared enemies of the United States and the rest of the Western world are inside the fence and doing evil all the time.
So
that's
how did
roughly
that happen?
That's the big scandal. Everything else compared with it is not significant.
How did
not
that come
me,
to
anyway?
People? How did that thing that you just said is so big that it just causes cognitive dissonance. People go, "What? Oh, what was the score in last night's game?" It's just so big that it doesn't. You can't leave it at that. How did it happen?
Happened very very slowly. It happened roughly on the same timeline as the Eurabia, which was the parallel process in Europe. Since we have more oil than most European countries have, ours isn't so closely tied to oil. Ours is tied to Saudi money that pays for the infiltration, that pays for the radicalization of the mosque. 80% of the mosques have violence-supporting material and tend towards the support of violence. And at the same time, the infiltrators worked their way into academia, which was helped by the same money that Diana talked about, those huge grants to Harvard and Yale and everywhere else. Georgetown is the epicenter of it all, Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. But getting them in the media has been one of the most important things. When you see somebody like Imam Rauf, who sounds so reasonable, so modern, so open-minded, so urbane. He's the face of Islam.
Wasn't he the one that just got busted for embezzlement?
I didn't hear that one. Somebody got busted. Imam Rauf is the Ground Zero mosque guy. Did they get him
yes,
for embezzlement?
Yes,
I didn't know that. That makes me happy.
Yeah, you know that much arrogance, you're going to make a mistake, right? And that's what he did. That guy is like, he's like one of Islam's best Grima worm tongues. If you read the stuff he wrote in Arabic and you compare it to the stuff he said on Fox News, they're polar opposites. Much like who's that Swiss fellow who's
Tariq Ramadan? Yes,
yeah.
Tariq Ramadan is the king of Taqiyya. Nobody can do it better than he can. But the Obama's man at the OSCE, he's the ambassador to the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, if I remember rightly, and his name is, I think, Rashid Hussein. Is that right?
I don't remember.
The guy who spoke at the OIC at the OSCE last year, the one that Elizabeth Sabadich Wolf and Henrik Rader Clausen went to. He's another Grima worm tongue. And he is – oh, no, I don't want to go any further into this because we would get lost in a labyrinth of Muslim Brotherhood in America stuff, and it could go on all night and all day tomorrow, and we still wouldn't be done.
Yes, and that's the problem. The problem is that it's that this conspiracy is so complex and so subtle at times that it can be kind of soporific, you know. Like it's the kind of you put that sort of explanation on, you know, as you're going to sleep at night. What the problem is that I think a lot of people are starting to wake up and look around and notice that there's been very fundamental changes. Like one example would be if you look even in my city in Ottawa, and you see the number of women that are wearing either just a cloth on the head or a cloth over the full face, which there just wasn't last year, and certainly not the year before. But the actual number of Muslim women hasn't changed much. So what exactly happened that suddenly everybody at least looks so much more religious? What do you think could have caused that?
Well, that's happening in Canada. I assume it's happening all through Europe. And I'm seeing more of them here. I was I think it was the last election, or it might have been the election before, I went down to the firehouse to vote, and I live in a very rural redneck area. This is out in the middle of nowhere. There's no towns around, no nothing. And I was standing behind a hijabed woman in line to vote. It gave me the creeps. I don't know where they live out here, but there are somewhere out here, there are colonies of them. And, of course, I've written about Jamaat al-Fukra. That's a bit farther away, but still not very far from me. Those are the compounds. And their women have always been covered, as far as I know. You see them in the supermarkets in places like Appomattox and Farmville. They come in with it's not niqab. It's the standard hijab dress they wear there. And they're generally African-Americans. You don't see Arabs or anything. The Jamaat al-Fukra is largely made up of converts that were made in prison, at least the men are, and then I presume they force their wives to convert. But anyway, what's happening in Europe, actually Europe has a better chance than we have, I think. People have long ago woken up in Europe, most of them. Whatever else is going on in England, in the UK, and in most of Western Europe, people know what's happening. They may not talk about it. They know they can get arrested or lose their jobs if they talk about it, but they're very well aware of what's going on. Am I right, Jeff?
Yes. Yes. This, as you say, people have lost their jobs. If they've been, you know, like being associated with within the EDL and that, and you've got the leftists, UAF or something, well, they're taking pictures. And what they do, these people take these pictures, they do a little bit of digging in depth, and what they do is they go around and they report them to their employees saying, well, you know what, you can bring all sorts of problems on yourself if you don't get rid of these people. And this is what we've been finding. People speak out against this cult, or, you know, sometimes they lose their jobs. And, you know, the thing about it is, Baron, that we've got so many people out there, unsung heroes, that does so many good works, but I salute them all. A lot of people that, you know, if they was to, you know, put their heads up over the top of the parapet as such, you know, they would lose their jobs. And but they do. There's so many good people out there. We've got to be very careful. You know, we must protect these people because they're some great people. They're the unsung heroes. So I salute them all. And that is the case, though. That is the case, what you're saying there. So,
I know a lot of those people. But yeah. In the USA... That's not true. The most significant one that I remember is when there was this place down in Charlotte County, which is the same place that the Jamaat al-Fukra compound is, and I went down to look for it. It was an Islamic school. It turned out to be unconnected with Jamaat al-Fukra, and it was hard to find. It was way out in the middle of nowhere down near the river, and I couldn't see where it was. I went to the local store, and I said, do you know where the Islamic school is? There's an Islamic school around here. And he said, yeah, and he gave me directions. And he said, hey, tell me, would you, what does Islamic mean? That's the level of ignorance that we deal with in this country. And because most of the country the ghettos are in Detroit, Brooklyn, California. The Somalis are in Minnesota and Tennessee, but most of the country doesn't see many of them. They're just, you know, they pop up at the mall or you run into them somewhere, but most of the country doesn't see Muslims. And ignorance is really widespread. People do not pay attention to what's going on, and what you see on the news, when you watch it about what's happening, most people aren't paying attention to it. And we do not have a populace that is aware of this. So we're in worse shape than you are in the UK, because almost everybody in the UK is aware of what's going on.
Well, I asked my question specifically because it's my suspicion that there are calls from the mosques that at certain points, when the population is numerous enough or in certain positions, where they assert their separateness more and more. So you end up with initially a Muslim population that pretty much just fits in and there are no issues. And then at a certain moment, suddenly the same people are wearing all these clothes that distinguish themselves and separate them from. And then if anyone objects to it, they get victim status. You know, like, oh,
and then,
the way people
and then
treat
they're
me
demanding Sharia. Not
yes.
About the same time they start demanding Sharia and getting it in Britain, but when their numbers are large enough, they basically take over, which, as far as I know, is happening in Marseille. Marseille is ruled by Islamic gangs, more or less, with a lot of
France,
violence involved. Yeah,
in
France.
Southern France, yeah.
Yeah. And parts of the Netherlands are verging on the same thing, and there's been a demand by that nutcase in Oslo for Islamic rule in those parts of Oslo that Muslims are in charge of, or rather numerous in. I can't remember the district names. Fjordman could tell us, but this guy said, we want Islamic rule. And you'll see more and more of that as time goes on. But we don't get that here in the USA. There aren't enough of them. They're not demanding Sharia here. The most they do is tell us that Sharia is compatible with our Constitution. The famous imam that said that 80% of Sharia is compatible with the United States Constitution. And we're being softened up, in other words. So that
yeah, exactly.
By the time the blade goes in, we don't feel it.
Yeah, yes, I mean, this is it. Yeah, it's what I've always called it as a stealth jihad. That's why I've always looked at it as a stealth, you know, quietly, you know, go, you know, don't make too many waves, just quietly, surely, until they get, you know, a firm hold, then bang.
Yeah.
And then they sort of impose their will upon the people.
But it's not stealthy anymore in Luton, is it?
Or
in Birmingham.
No. Exactly. I mean, we're getting what we call it now, galloping jihad.
That's more like it.
That's what I would say, but it's a galloping jihad. We spoke about that before. But if just before we continue, because this is absolutely awesome to have yourself on the show this evening, but I'd just like to just mention to all our listeners out there, ladies and gentlemen, tonight on the East Anglian's EDL radio show, we've got a great honour and privilege to be having on the show tonight Baron Bodisi, the gates of Vienna's great blood. And most of us who's connected with what we do, and that, you can't have missed that. The same with Vlad Tepes with his great blog. We've got, as I say, this is a great show this evening. If I do sit back and I'm a little bit quiet now and again, guys, it's because I'm so engrossed with what we're talking about. So I might go a bit quiet simply because I get involved with the conversation. I'm nodding and making notes and this, that, and the other. But so I hope everybody out there in the radio world is enjoying this. This is the first time you've done an interview on the radio. I think what Vlad was saying earlier on there, Barry. So I'm not sure. Is this the first time?
I've been on the radio. I don't think I've been on the radio in Europe before, though. I think it's always been American. But I've been on different radio shows different times over the years.
That's good. By the way, I'd like to just take this opportunity to tell people about your site, which is gatesofvienna.net. That's Gates of Vienna, and hopefully we're going to find out exactly why it's called that, .net. And for those of you listening that are unaware of the site, please start checking it regularly because it's very important content. And for those of you that are aware of the site and do visit it, please consider that it's completely donation run. If you can find it in your heart and in your wallet to come up with 5 or 10 monetary units, you know, please consider going to their PayPal button, whether it's dollars, pounds, or euros. And if you get whatever, I'm sure they'd be appreciative for it because they do very, very important work. And they were one of the first sites to recognize the issue and that had the courage to come out and start talking about it, and I'm sure at some great personal expense in a number of different ways. Why is it called Gates of Vienna, please?
The city of Vienna, the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was besieged twice by the Ottoman Turks in the name of Jihad and Allah. The first siege was in 1529, and the Turks were pushed back. And the second time was in 1683, when the Turkish Sultan sent Mehmet Pasha, I've just lost his name, but his military commander to besiege Vienna again. He was hoping that by overthrowing Vienna and taking over Austria, the gates to the Rhine Valley would be open to him, and basically the Turks would be able to overrun Europe all the way to the English Channel. And it looked like he might succeed because France was the enemy of Austria and worked against it, and the Allies were squabbling among themselves. The Turks besieged Vienna, but at the last minute, the King of Poland led a contingency of Polish hussars and other troops to Vienna and broke the siege and routed the Turks. And they were driven back from Vienna, and that was the last time the Turks threatened the heart of Europe. Over the next 100 years, they were pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, and they never got another chance to take the heart of Europe.
Until now.
Yeah, and this time the Turks are in Vienna again. They were invited inside the gates by the multicultural commissars of Vienna. Come on in, fellows. We'd love to have you. That's the way it is all over Western Europe.
What was the calendar date of that, when the Polish king arrived, please? When the Polish
He arrived on at the Wienerwald on September 11th, 1683, and the actual battle was the following morning.
That's interesting. So I wonder if September 11th has any significance in the modern jihad. I'll have to stop and think about that. So,
well, certainly. That's the September 11th is the date that they rioted about the movie, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, exactly. In Libya. So, what made you start? Did you have a life before you started this website?
Sometimes it doesn't seem like it. I was still working back then, so it was very part time. My wife Dimfna was more in charge of it than I was back then, and then when I got laid off, I started doing it full time. Really started working, and I started specializing in Europe, all because of Fjordman, really. But I gradually got drawn into European affairs, and it just snowballed from there. I never intended it. I don't know what I'd do if I had it to go back and do over again, but I never intended it.
Wondering if I could possibly. I did have. We've got a guy, Alec, back in the chat. He was asking me.
Alec.
Yeah, he was asking me to ask you about the Nick Baron Bodici. I was wondering if you'd like to share that with I guess in the chat room. Of course, to our listening audience out there. Go ahead, Darren.
Oh, yeah, well, it's very obscure. I picked it because it was obscure, and I figured nobody else would have the same nick. And Unspeak Baron Bodici is not just a fictional character. He's a fictional writer used as a reference in the footnotes of novels by the science fiction writer Jack Vance. He's not an actual character in the book. Characters in the book cite Baron Bodici, and there are footnotes in the books where Baron Bodici is cited. He's an imaginary commentator on social issues.
Wow.
And because I'm a Jack Vance fan, the name Baron Bodici meant a lot to me, and occasionally a Jack Vance fan will write to me and because he recognizes the reference. And he's not well known as Jack Vance. He's almost 100 years old, and he's been writing for 60 or 70 years. But he's one of my favorite novelists, and that's why I chose the name.
Oh, as I say, thank you for that insight. As I say, because many times I looked at myself and I thought, and Alex just asked that, and to ask me to ask you. And so that was quite a bit of insight there. So it was it's a fictional name from a fiction writer as such.
Yeah, and occasionally I've quoted the real Baron Bodici, so to speak, the real Baron Bodicey at the blog. I'll take a book and scan one of the footnotes with his writings in it and put it on the blog just for fun.
So just to bring it back to U.S. politics, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I understand that Hillary Clinton's best BFF is back in the news again today. The woman with connections to the Muslim Brotherhood that seemed to be quite interwoven with everything the State Department does. Do you know much about her?
Uma Abedin.
That's the
name. I don't know a whole lot about her. I followed the news about her, and I know that her family, her father, her mother, that it's like an all-Muslim Brotherhood family, and that she's married to what's his name? Wiener. Wiener with a wiener. Am I allowed to say that on the radio here?
Yeah, absolutely.
She is Hillary Clinton's closest associate, as far as I hear. And, yeah, I saw the headlines today, too, but I haven't had a chance to read the news stories yet. Vlad, why don't you talk about what they say?
I just want to check my mic. Is everything okay? Can I be heard?
Yeah, I hear you.
Hello? Okay, good. There was an error I just saw an error on the thing. It said I wasn't connected. So there you go, I am. That's a good kind of error, I guess. So I heard that she was – New York Times has a piece on her right now. Let me see what it is that she did. Apparently she had built out a great deal of time while working for the State Department as a consultant, and you're not really supposed to do that, I think. And so the New York, I find it interesting that organizations like MSNBC, which is calling the Obama administration tyrannical, and organizations like the New York Times, that basically made him, are starting to look at some of these things that groups like Center for Security Policy have been exposing for years, and they're noticing, wait a minute, there's a problem with this administration. It may not be quite what they presented it to be. I'm just going to try to find the article. Whoops. It's a little tricky because tabs are opening left, right, and center. Where are we now? Yeah, let's see. Wiener's wife didn't disclose consulting work she did while serving in State Department. I mean, it sounds, again, like that sort of boring, bureaucratic, but they're very careful when they name the organization she worked for. It just looks like there's a lot of strange interconnections and flagrant breaches of protocol for somebody in a position like hers. I mean, if you're actually working that closely with the head of the State Department, one would think that a certain amount of discretion would go along with that, as opposed to sort of pimping yourself out to every organization that will pay you. It just strikes me as being another log on this bonfire that is the Obama administration right now. So I was hoping you'd know something more about her and her Muslim Brotherhood connections, because isn't her entire family deeply connected to the MB?
Yes, as I recall, I know her mother and father. I can't remember what siblings might be involved, but her mother started an organization, and she was like the head of the Muslim Sisterhood or something, the female version of the Muslim Brotherhood, or a chapter of it anyway. But you have to remember that I specialize in European affairs, and though I read everything on American affairs, I don't always have it down like the American, like Diana West has it, say, the American commentators. Even though I'm an American, for some reason I ended up specializing in European affairs.
That's fair enough. Well, let's bring it back to England then. I have a question, as loaded as it's going to be. Are you familiar with the UN definition of genocide? Maybe somebody can Google it. We should get that up. Okay, you are familiar with it. Based on that, doesn't European immigration policy basically completely fit within that definition? I mean, as it's been for the last 10 or 20 years? I mean, isn't population replacement specifically listed as genocide and forbidden according to the United Nations?
As far as I know, it is, but anybody who attempts to get the United Nations to enforce anything except against Western people is engaging in futile activity. The law is, all laws are enforced very selectively now, as anybody in England can attest to. You can say all the racist things you like about white people, and especially if you're not white, but if you so much as say, "I don't like the color of his sail," about somebody, you're in trouble if you're white. So,
what?
That's a good point.
And we have to remember that our governments now, and I'm talking about anywhere in Europe pretty much, and in the United States and Canada, our governments are so huge and powerful that they can do whatever they want, and the law is whatever the government and the prosecutors say is the law. And since the media fall into line fairly easily, there's no real check on the power of the government. You can be as good as you like and as law-abiding as any person can be, and which is hard because there are so many laws against so many things nowadays. But and you, if the government decides you're a nuisance, they'll take you down. So, and if,
the
but
best
if you're,
okay, they've been trying over here, especially with, you know, as Kevin Carroll once said, they're doing their best to take down the leadership and, you know, imprison, give people a long prison sentence to try to put people off sort of speaking out like what we've continued to do. And that does seem to be the case of what you was just expressing there, Baron. So, yeah, that does seem to be the case. But it comes to a stage where, you know, people saying, you know, you could do this to us, you could do this. You know what, you're not going to silence us. We're going to continue. No matter what you throw at us, no matter, you know, what goes on, we're still going to speak out against these things. It's wrong. It's hurting our nation. It's going to hurt our future generations. And that is why we're here, because we're thinking of our future. The future is important to us all. You know, and that is why what we're doing today, it's so important for the future. We have to come together as one on this issue. We've got no choice. It's our calling, every single one of us. I've always thought that. We've got to do something. We can't just sit back and let these things happen to our great nations. You know, because otherwise we'll be, in a very short few years, we'll be living in, well, we won't, probably most of us won't be around, because we'll be a part of that. We'll be put to side, or, you know, whatever's going to come our way. But we're not going to. I think that the reason we're here, it's our calling. Every one of us is our calling. And the reason why we're so involved, because it's so important. Would you not agree, though? It's so important what we do, and we must continue to speak out and tell the truth. Because that's all it's about. It's getting the truth out there.
Well, this is the single great issue of our time. There is no other issue greater. Even though communism, socialism, and leftists in general are responsible for getting us into this, they're the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, the virus that kills us, the pneumonia, or the Kaposi sarcoma, whatever it's called, Kaposi sarcoma, that kills us is Islam. We are going to be taken down by Islam after the leftists have weakened us sufficiently, and we're actually coming very close to that.
Critical point, I would say. Would you not?
Yeah, it may be. I don't think I'm going to live to see the denouement of it. You know, I'm old, but like Tommy's going, you know, if he stays out of trouble and doesn't get beaten to death at any point, Tommy will be is young enough that he'll be around when it, whatever happens. Vlad may be around because he's younger than I am. If think about all these people, and some of them, the ones with children, are the ones who really should be concerned. That's why Elizabeth is so active, because she knows what her daughter will be facing in 25 or 30 years.
Of course.
In Vienna.
So much sooner. Yeah. According to Stephen Coghlan, the timeline for, I think he said, out-and-out open warfare, basically globally, according to the Muslim Brotherhood plan, is 2016. So I don't think we're going to have to wait all that long to see it. I mean, let's just say that he's right, and so far he always is. I think that the question is, we need to get as many people aware of the reality on the ground as possible before that. I mean, obviously, there's going to come a time pretty soon where it's either you get it or you're so self-deluded that you will never get it. And essentially, you're on the other side. So our job, our mission here, whether you're a blogger, doing a radio program, whatever, has got to be just to present evidence and de-spin the grotesque alternate reality that mass media, through selective enforcement and political correctness, address. You know, in a weird way, I've got to give a certain kind of marks to some of the news agencies that we've grown to despise. Actually, when you watch what they say very carefully, they've managed to find a way to tell us the truth, even though they're not allowed to. Right? Especially British media has all kinds of rules on it that say what you can say, what you can't say. That you're allowed to name this group if the person who did it did a certain event, was a member of that group, even if there was no actual group ideology or there's no actual group connection. That was too vague. Let's say that somebody in, I don't know, let's say Norway, commits a grotesque and horrible act of mass murder for political purposes, right? Just hypothetically. And let's say that he had absolutely no ties to any ideology other than his own or any group, but claims he did. The media will insist up and down that it was a Christian act, or it was a far right wing, or whatever they can, and the media is not, and governments are encouraged to tell that lie. But if somebody is has a mass rape gang of young girls where they're actually taking white slaves, and there's no other way to accurately represent what it is they're doing. You've got groups of Muslim males specifically going out, and it turns out there was a story the other day that it was being taught, and the imams are preaching this. The actual people, the mosques, they're actually explaining how to do this and encouraging men to do this in the mosques themselves, which is another good reason not to imagine that a mosque and a church have anything in common. So, but when they're caught, governments and media go out of their way, and it's by policy, it's by design, not to say that this is Islamic doctrine and that it's connected to an Islamic community and that it is, you know, they go out of the way, they'll call them, okay, which brings me to another point I really wanted
it's
to mention.
It's true. I would agree there. Well, 100%. Why? They go out of their way to explain it off as some other situation, but that's what we know. We're not. They try to think that we're stupid.
Well, now hold on. Yes, that's true. The people who set the policy think that. But you know what? These news agencies sometimes manage to find a way to sneak in a few words so that we know. It's not that we're being clever when we figure it out. It's that these I think sometimes, not always, but some of these news agencies are actually trying to tell us the truth despite policies that cripple them and hobble them from actually reporting news. And they'll put in a few clever keywords so that we go. Because if they really didn't want us to know, they would manage to withhold enough information. Now, you know what would be great to see in Europe? Japanese and Chinese and Hindu and Jain and Zoroaster groups get together and sue every agency that uses the word Asian when they're describing.
You know what? I'm nodding my head because many times I've said this, that we've heard what they say. They don't use our name. Don't use this because Asian covers a lot of different, as you say, Japanese, Chinese, Hindu, Sikhs. It covers a big aspect. And there's a specific group that could be causing these problems. And we talk about all the time. These is Pakistani Muslims who are doing it. And that is it. When they say that, they're trying to evade, categorize everybody as one. And that's wrong because, as you say, you're depicting other different groups of people. Asian covers a lot.
Which has no connection to these crimes. Now, the thing is, these crimes are ideologically driven, and they're committed by Muslims. Now, here's the great, horrific disgusting irony, and that is that governments have obviously instructed the media that it's racist to say that it's Muslims doing it, even though Islam's not a race. But it's not racist to say that Asians are doing it, even though Asians are a race. So the media has been taught, in order to appease leftist sensibilities, to be overtly and systemically racist in order not to appear crypto-racist by naming the people an ideology that actually is committing these perverse acts. Which brings me to this question of Islamophobia. This is a good question for the Baron. What the hell is it, and where did it come from?
The term, you mean? It
yes,
was
please.
Coined by, it was invented by Iran more than, it was a long time ago, 30 years ago, I think. Iran coined it to serve their propaganda, probably around the same time they came after Salman Rushdie, that, to deal with the reaction that against Islam that happened after that. By the way, those of you who are old enough, do you remember when it was okay to be kind of anti-Islamic back when, after the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran and the few years after that? The bomb Iran,
it was quite common.
Yeah, it was quite common. And back then you could still see satire on television that mocked Islam. And all of that's gone.
Yeah, that's good point. Yeah, I remember that. I remember them days. I'll go back a bit. It's true.
And after the first World Trade Center bombing, there was quite a bit of it. I saw after 9/11, sometime after 9/11, I was in a motel watching TV and saw a movie that came out before 9/11. I can't remember the name of it, but it was about a terrorist attack on New York City. And it was the usual lefty claptrap, but they were Islamic terrorists, and you don't have Islamic terrorists in the movies very much anymore, if at all. It's always neo-Nazis or something. It's simply not allowed to portray Muslims as terrorists or violent or anything like that.
How true. I mean, that was just say, there was a time when it would be quite, you know, there'd be films made about it, and they say, and you used to, I remember this, we used to have some shows on our television, and it would depict Islamic terrorists, blah, blah, blah. And it was sad, but now it's changed. It quickly just changed, slowly but surely, just changed over portraying them as foreign agents, whatever they may be. It's just they didn't want to use the words anymore, and it's the way that they've been directed. It's the way they've been told, no, we can't do this. We're not allowed to go down that line anymore, simply because of what's going on. We're politically orientated as such. So they're going down that line now, by the looks of it. So
yeah,
that's what we've come to see over the years, isn't it, Baron?
And you even have laws against it now in the UK, religiously aggravated public order offense, Section 5, right? I mean, they can actually prosecute you for doing it, as far as I know.
Yeah, I think you're right. As I say, going back quite a few years ago now, they tried to bring in the blasphemy laws. Well, into this country, or introduce them, we just missed it by one vote. And I think that's when Blair was about. We missed it by one vote. But it does seem, even though we've missed it by one vote, it does seem that it has crept in, and they are using it. They're trying to use it, you know, under different the hate speech, whatever. It's just crept in like that. So I would say that even though that we haven't got the blasphemy laws here, they've got them actually. They've got the blasphemy laws in Ireland. I know that definitely, because that you're not allowed to mention anything because you can be prosecuted. But I think we missed it. But at the same time, they're still, if you say something that they think that maybe that's a class of hate speech, it might be just something quite mild. They would categorise it. So, yes, times have changed, and that's what we're seeing today, aren't we, Baron?
Yes, we are.
In this country, anyway. Yeah.
Well, it's happening all through Europe. We're still better off here. That guy who made the Muhammad movie they could only get him for it because he'd already broken the law. And, of course, I believe he was set up anyway, but that's another story. But the year in jail he's enjoying right now, they could only do it because he'd already broken the law and was on probation and violated the terms of his probation by doing certain things like making movies probably. But as of right now, as long as I'm careful to avoid actual incitement to violence, I am probably not able to be prosecuted for what I say here in the United States.
No, that's right. And it's the way, I've always thought that. Sometimes as we do radio, we've got to be very careful the way we choose our words. There are so many people that listens to what we say. So I'm very careful. At the same time, I will say we don't go down to a politically correct way that we always conduct the shows as such, but we will speak out against the stories that some of the media will not cover.
You have to be very careful now, and actually I have to be very careful too, because if I step over a certain line, I mean, Blogger took down the Blogger version of the Blogspot version of our blog, and they might have done it for political reasons, and now Gates of Vienna is hosted independently and is less vulnerable, but political pressure can still be brought to bear on people, on services. So we have to be careful. But I've noticed that there are plenty of blogs out there where people say anything they want, and even what I would call incitement. And these are American blogs, I mean. So there's generally a free for all, which is good. But I advise something. Vlad and I like humor. We like. He told you about the mustards and the Pop Tarts and as the repression kicks in, it's going to be harder to be funny. You won't be able to talk about ragheads and wogs and things like that anymore. If you can't, I don't think you can now. But that I recommend satire, irony, and sarcasm, where it's much harder to get you. An example that I use is to refer to the people who have been imported into our countries as cultural enrichment or culture enrichers. When it comes down to it, everybody knows that joke. When they read our blog, they know I'm being sarcastic, but it can't be brought up in a court of law for it. Speaking well of them as these wonderful culture enrichers. And another one is the Muhammad coefficient, which is what I assign to criminals. You know, there was one it was all because of one in Yorkshire. I think it was one of the early grooming and pimping things in Yorkshire where all four of the criminals were called Muhammad. All four men who were charged were called Muhammad. And that's when I invented the Muhammad coefficient. And you just assign the percentage to the number of Mohammeds, Mahmouds, Mehmets, Mahmoud, and all those other things, that all those variations on Muhammad. And it's factual, you know. 25% of the accused are named Mohammed. It's not like it's insulting. Your audience is going to understand what you mean, but it'd be awfully hard to get caught on a point of law with it. And there's a lot of things that can be done. I advise people nowadays, especially in Britain, to heed the words of Jesus and be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. That is, you have to realize that the powers that be are out to get you, and they are going to get you if they want to, and you can only put it off for so long. And in the meantime, you have to walk a narrow, straight line. The lefties don't have to worry about that. The people in Unite Against Fascism don't have to worry about what they do in their spare time. But if you're an Islamophobe and you sleep with somebody else's wife or get a little too drunk and break bottles in the street, you're going to get busted for it and you're going to do hard time. And it's a good idea to remember that all the time.
I agree. We agree with that. Yes. I was going to say, Vlad and Baron, I was wondering, because I
think we deserve a little break for maybe a couple of minutes or so. So I was wondering, are you okay for time there? But I'm just going to say, just have a little break and then we'll continue, because it's, what can I say, absolutely enthralling tonight. I hope all the great listening audience out there, and of course we've got a lot of guests in the chat room is listening. I hope you're enjoying Baron Baldisi of the Gates of Vienna blog. Absolutely awesome. And of course we've got our own Vlad Tepes, our co-host of the show once again tonight. Absolutely brilliant, Vlad. So I thought we deserve a little break. We've been working hard, haven't we, guys? So
I could use a couple of minutes,
Okay, Vlad. And this is one I did play last night. I don't want to overdo it, but it's called An England Scorn, Vlad, Baron. So I hope you, I know I've played it before, but let's play it again, because I just like it. Hope you, any listeners out there, if you haven't heard this before, we played it last night, and it's just one that I really like at this moment in time. So hope you enjoy it, and it just gives us a little time to have a little break. So we'll
just a quick heads up. After the break, I may have just stumbled across, thanks to one of my site's most prolific tipsters, M. There's a video of the French priest that was assaulted, and the Archbishop warning of a Muslim takeover in France. Maybe we can all have a look at that after the break.
Thank you. You're absolutely. Thank you very much, dear Vlad. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back straight after the break. So thank you. Here we go.
Sit there in your shirt and tie, boldly dictating a crooked smile while you fed us lies. You didn't trust your own persuading. You served us lying to keep at bay the few good men that warned. While the dawn is nigh, look to the sky, beware of an England scorned. For the riddle I die, for the riddle I. You were bought with coin and you played your part and you'll live to rue the day. You smite the ways of our hallowed land and ignore the plight of our people, while you grease the stranger's outstretched hand and shout that all are equal. There'll be bitter cries for your deeds and lies when Willard sounds the horn. And the Norns will glide through English sky and you'll reap an England scorned.
Well, there you go. That was an England school by the Dubliners. And, ladies and gentlemen, once again, I'd like to, once again, you're listening to Baron Bodisi of the Gates of Vienna, and a prolific blogger, absolutely awesome. And, of course, Vlad Tepes, once again, a co-host of the show. So, welcome back, guys. Hope you enjoyed your little break there.
Yes,
just give me time, give me a cup of tea.
I actually did. I printed myself a chai latte on my coffee printer. What do you call that thing? A Tassimo.
There you go.
It's
the
funniest little thing.
You need a little break. No, you just need a little, because you do get a little bit dry when we do a little bit. So it's nice to have that, just that little bit of break. And as I say, welcome back, Baron. I hope you got yourself a nice cup of tea or a cup of coffee.
Well, I attended to some other matters while the song was on.
Yep, I do. Okay, so we never did finish out the Islamophobia thing, though. You said that it was initially invented in Iran.
Yeah, it was coined by the Iranians. I don't know the details, but it was like 30 years ago. And it became back into prominence even before 9/11, because you remember how it was after the Kohl bombing in the year 2000, and even after the Khobar Tower bombing in 1995, people started to look at Osama bin Laden and hear about Islamic terrorism. You know, so the Muslims had to get out there and call what we, not we, but people like us, what they said, Islamophobia. And the term was already out there waiting to be used, ready to be used by Muslims and by leftists. Because remember, the term is modeled on homophobia. That is, it was riffing on homophobia.
Actually, once I remember being on a bus going down one of Ottawa's main streets, and it was a very nice day, and I looked out the window, and there was a homeless guy that was sitting amongst a collection of his objet de bum, I guess, and he had a big sign that said, give money, help fight hobophobia. And I thought that was incredibly clever. Hobophobia. But, you know, that's like, that guy should be working in the government. I guess in a weird way he was. So, yes, I think the term was out there. And I think that it's way more significant than it looks on the surface, because
It is. It's medicalizing what we say. And it's getting worse, because everything is being medicalized. Virtually anything, any form of dissent is becoming a medical ailment, a psychological ailment, as it was in the Soviet Union.
Mm.
If you support the Tea Parties, you have bipolar condition or whatever. You know, recommending psychotropic medications for people who get angry over political events, instead of saying, I wonder if there is something legitimate about what they're saying. No, they're just mentally ill. We need to medicate them.
Isn't this what the Russians used to do? If you don't
that
know,
is
me,
what the Russians used to do. It was the and it's still done in other places. I presume they do it in China, but they certainly do it in other places.
So it's quite obvious they're trying to interject that into our societies, this, that, and the other, that they're trying to
it's
use.
It's already happening.
Term.
I believe they do it in Norway. I wish
good
I
grief.
Had Fjordman on the line, but I believe that people do get diagnosed with medical, psychological conditions for certain kinds of political opinion.
So if you're making a political opinion opposition statement, you can have a medical term that they could lock you up and say that you've got a mental condition.
There's another sort of subtle little shift that happens with the concept of homophobia and Islamophobia, which is, I think, that sort of gets missed, and that is that there's a difference, there's a significant difference between dealing with people in terms of a thing for which they cannot help. In other words, if you're born in one of a dozen different ethnicities, right? Like if you're born, a Sherpa, right? Then it would be reasonable, perhaps, to have laws that say that you can't actively discriminate against Sherpas. You have to apply the merit principle. If this Sherpa is more capable of carrying your suitcase up a mountain, then hire him. But if he's not, if he's less capable of dribbling a basketball down a court, then don't hire him. So that's reason, right? So there's no Sherpa phobia. There's no issue of Sherpa phobia, but it would be more logical if there was one, if they said don't, you know, fight Sherpa phobia, because the person couldn't help being born a Sherpa, right? But when you talk about gayness, you're running into a slightly different issue, because it's a behavior. Whether or not it's an innate behavior or not, that jury's still out. But at the moment, it's still a behavior. And then with religion, well, it's entirely voluntary, right? A person could say, I believe in this. No, wait, I believe in that. No, no, wait. I've had a couple of beers now, so I actually believe in this other thing. Belief is not something about which there's any basis and reason to apply a law, or even a term like Islamophobia. It's ridiculous. I mean, with Jews, it's a different matter because there's an ethnicity associated with it, and because Hitler turned Jews from a religion into a race, right? Whether it is or not, it's a different issue. I'm talking about in terms of popular culture perception and in terms of the way that groups and governments have treated Jewish people. They've treated them as if they were a race, as if they were a black, white, Jewish, whatever, right? It had nothing to do with what they believed after Hitler, but it did before. With Islam, there's no blog, not Gates of Vienna, there's no blog that has an issue with a person who might identify themselves as Muslim but doesn't carry any of those beliefs. You know what I mean? That they're culturally Muslim or whatever. The issue is directly proportional to the extent with which they are believing and acting in accordance with Islamic doctrine. And that's a reasonable thing. If you can't oppose people that are acting in accordance with an enemy dogma like Nazism, communism, Islam, a Shinto, a great historical example, well, then isn't it kind of an engineered surrender?
And it's important to emphasize that Islam is mostly a political ideology. It's not the religion is relatively minor. Didn't Bill Warner do an analysis of the Quran, maybe the Hadith too, which showed that 2/3 of the text was about various political things? Isn't that do you know that, Vlad?
I don't remember that specific thing, but having read all that stuff myself, like having read the Quran and everything, I mean, it's almost you can just imagine some 50-year-old guy talking to a bunch of 14 and 15-year-old boys and saying, if you do this for me, this is what you'll get if you get killed doing it. I mean, you read it and you realize it just sounds so much like a middle-aged guy trying to con a bunch of teenagers into risking their lives for that guy's political advantage, for the three, geez, I'd have to come up with the right alliteration here, but for power, sexual access, which might start with a P, and money, right? I mean, that's all it was about. That's all. When you read it, you just go, it's so obvious, and it should be embarrassing to the Islamic world that they're still. I mean, that's why I guess they want a caliph back so badly, because it's organized like the mafia, right? You have captains,
yeah,
and you kick up to them, and then the captains kick up to the head of the family or whatever, and you've got these dons. And Islam needs a don. They need someone to kick up to so that it justifies them going out in the name of jihad and stealing and raping and looting and taking property and all to spread Islam. But, I mean, even – I think there's a great quote. I shouldn't really make sure I have this stuff in front of me but I think the Quran says something about Mohammed explaining to one of the people who dared ask him a question about the constant inconsistencies in his preaching, why their God, why the pirate Mohammed's deity would make so many people not believe in it when they heard about this stuff. Why they would? He said something like that God, that Allah had made people deliberately deaf and blind to the message in order to give victims to Muslims to fight or something. Are you familiar with that passage, Baron?
No, I'm not. I don't remember that one.
So I'll have to look it up. But he had actually explained that it was part of the great divine plan that people would be fooled. They would be deliberately blinded in order to give targets to just like, it's just so insane. And again, as I said at the beginning of the show, not all cultures come from Greek roots. If it did, if the Arabic culture at that time had basis in Greek thought, they would examine this and go, this is absurd, and they'd just drop it.
Actually, there is a link that I've got to thank Darren Wall tonight for putting some great links into the chat room, what we've been talking about. So if anybody wants to catch up with some of these great links there, it's been posted, please do. As I say, it's talking about all the things what we've been discussing.
Well, there's the Bill Warner link, right? Understanding Trend, right?
Yeah.
Right? Maybe can you publish this chat on the EDL website afterwards, or?
Yeah. It certainly will do.
What
I'd like to do just before we continue, because the time starts to wind down a little bit, I was wondering just because we've got some great guest chats in the chat room this evening, who really helps the show along what they do. So I'll do just a quick roll call for everybody. I'd say they got myself is Jeff, and Surrender EDL. We got Vlad. Tepes is a co-host tonight. Once again, great job as usual. They're doing a great job there, bro. Also, we got Alec Buck. He's also been a wealth of information. Thank you very much. Darren Wall, what can I say? Thank you so much. You've been very, very busy in the chat room this evening. And, of course, we've got Frank G.A. He's a regular as well. Thank you, Frank, for being here tonight. And we've got quite a few guests we have in, so we'll give them everybody a wave. And, of course, we got Ivan Hummel. He's very much that's what goes on the show as a producer. He's just great. Big wave to you, Ivan. And of course, we got Jenny Archibald. Once again, worked very hard within the EDL. And, of course, if I've missed anybody out, my apologies, because my screen jumps now and again, so my apologies. We've got Poppy, not forgetting Poppy, and she is instrumental to so much of the work that we do and the links, this, that, and that. She's great. So thank you all, and not forgetting our great listening audience out there. So tonight we've got great guests on the show this evening, Baron Badisi of the Gates of Vienna. So let's continue. Sorry about that. I just had to have a quick read down, so... I'll give everybody away. So, thank you. Thank you so much. Let me just have a quick wave for everybody in the chat room. Thank you all for being here and supporting the show. So, yeah. So,
does anybody out there want to call in with a question, or does anybody have any questions in the chat room?
If anybody wants to call in there, if you've got the Skype, if you might click on the Skype. I should have done this earlier, but I was so engrossed. My apologies. If you're hooked up to Skype, you might click on the Skype and just follow the prompts, and we'll see if we can bring you in. But if you put the thing up, put one on there, so as we know that you... I've got a decline in. Sorry, Alec. I'm sorry, I had to decline. It's probably a bad call being on there. So, but the number to call in, if you're outside the USA, the number to call in is 001-858-777-5934. I repeat, 001-858-777-5934. So if you want to call in, please do. If you want to ask Barbara Badisi any questions, please. That's what we're here for this evening. So, thanks for that, for giving me a heads up there. I was so carried away with what we've been discussing tonight. It's been absolutely enthralling. Thank you.
Jeff, is your audience is mainly England, right? And a lot of largely EDL rank and file, is that right?
We've got a lot of from the UK, a lot of people tune into, but we've got I think there's 30% of our audience is American and Canadian based, so we've got quite a mixed audience and such.
Wow.
And not only that, we've got other people listen. It's the internet radio, and it's people listen to us all around the world there, Baron.
I have an opportunity here that I don't want to miss, which is to talk to some EDL people. I have a couple of ideas. I mentioned earlier that as the repression increases, what we do is going to become increasingly illegal, and we're going to get arrested for it anyway. Not me personally, because I'm across the Atlantic, but you over there. And I think it's important, if you're going to get arrested, it shouldn't be for leaving a pig's head at a mosque or writing death to Muslims on a wall or throwing a brick through an Islamic Center window. I think it's, if you're going to get arrested anyway, it's a good idea to get arrested for something for which will gain you a lot of sympathy. And the idea that I'm about to give you was thought up by Paul Weston. Most of you know Paul.
Yes.
He thought it would be a good idea. It has to be somebody who can read well, has a good voice, and you have to have good videotape of it. But the idea is to read in a prominent public place from Winston Churchill's account of the River War, which most of our listeners know that one because it's quoted very widely, what Winston Churchill said about Mohammedans back in 1898,
yes, wasn't it? Yes.
Right. To read that in public now would, if the law were applied equally, to read that in public would be a public order offense, a religiously aggravated public order offense under Section 5. And Paul always thought that that would be an excellent way to gain positive publicity, to be arrested for reading from Winston Churchill. So I throw that out there for anybody who is interested in being arrested for the cause. Chances are you'll have to spend a lot of time and money on lawyers if you do it, but you would end up with public sympathy, and you won't get public sympathy if you throw a beer bottle at a Muslim, but you will get public sympathy for that.
You know what? That is incredible advice.
The second one, Vlad and I have talked about this one, is burning the Raya. Now, the Raya is what's also called the Black Flag of Jihad. It has it's black and it has white Arabic lettering on it, and says,
that's right,
in Arabic, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his pirate. And now, the reason why I'm mentioning it this now is that a few days ago, the Daily Telegraph referred to that flag as an Al-Qaeda flag. And that's a fortunate and auspicious moment for the English Defense League to call that black flag of jihad an Al-Qaeda flag, because that's the flag that Anjem Chowdhury and Sharia for All and all those different groups carry around when they do their demonstrations. You see the black flag all through London and Birmingham and Luton when they get out there on the streets and do their thing. I think they burn poppies, and I think the public burning of the Raya, the black flag of jihad, it'll probably get you arrested. But if the Telegraph has called that the Al-Qaeda flag, you are being arrested for burning the flag of Al-Qaeda, which is going to get you sympathy. You are not going to look bad in the press if you get arrested for that, like you would if you burned down a mosque or something. So I'm just throwing those two ideas out there, and I think that people can come up with more, but it's time, with EDL people being arrested for blinking, I think it's a time to get them arrested for the right kinds of things instead of for being drunk in public or whatever. You know, the things they get arrested for are astonishing. That fellow up in, it was somewhere up north, he got arrested for saying something when there weren't any Muslims around. He was singing a song about Muhammad or something, and the policeman heard him and arrested him. He got charged, tried, convicted, and sentenced for something that nobody except other EDL people and one policeman heard. It's incredible what people get arrested for.
That's a famous Zen koan answered. That's a famous Zen Buddhist koan actually answered. If an EDL member says something against Islam where no Muslim can hear him, is he still guilty of a hate crime? Now we have the answer.
Definitely.
But, back to the thing about reading from Churchill. That's absolutely magnificent. And I would suggest, should somebody decide to do that, that they don't hire lawyers, that they plead guilty and ask to go to jail. Because that is how you'll actually demonstrate the state of the UK. There'd be no way to disguise that. It would be absolutely first-rate evidence.
Let's talk to Paul and see if he wants to do it. I don't know if Paul would be up for it. He's got the voice for it, though. Paul could do the reading.
Yeah, he's got great
because,
voice.
You know,
got to...
tyrannies and soft tyrannies have been taken down by that kind of thing before,
yes,
where you put
yes.
the government in an embarrassing
yes.
situation and they jail somebody for something which is so conspicuously in the interest of the public it's an abuse of process, an abuse of law. And that simple act is magnificent. I tip my hat to you, definitely. If they read...
this is the way it works. Right now, when you get arrested for something, you know, if you get arrested for saying nuke the ragheads, they've got you on hate. You said something hateful, and people don't sympathize with you. So it seems legitimate to prosecute you for that. What we're looking for is something that either the government prosecutes you for it and thereby exposes its tyrannical nature, because it will be exposed. It can't hide anymore. It's a tyranny once it does that. Or they have to let you do it, in which case they have set a precedent for making something legal, which would be proclaiming what Winston Churchill said about Mohammedans. Either way, it's win-win, except that for the poor schmo who has to go to jail for it. It's win-win. And by the way, that jail, wherever he goes, will be full of Muslims. Don't forget that, Vlad.
Yeah. That's right. This is what we find. I was going to say, before we, because I said we're running down on time. I've got Ivan. Once you possibly, Brad, if you, I've been asking if you could email Ivan. So he's very much so. He's producer of the show, and I'm wondering. I'm going to pass you his email. Maybe I don't know if I should do this. Live, as I say, actually, but
no,
I've got
drop it offline, either in a Skype window or an email to me.
I'll do that, Ivan. I'll do that. Yeah, if we can, I'll pass you his email address and say for and ask him to mail what he's saying. Now that's what he was giving, but I didn't know how to go back. So we'll do that in the Skype box. So once again, I just see it come up. I thought I better mention just to give you a heads up, like if you know, we get in touch and so there's he went to post some stuff and that. But oh, it's actually what can I say about tonight? Barrowboat easy. I mean, my goodness me. We've covered so much. I hope you will come on a later show as well. You know, I hope you've enjoyed here tonight with us, and it's been so engrossing. And I think everybody out there, our great listeners out there, have enjoyed everything what you've been saying tonight. And of course, Vlad, and it's been so interesting, and really getting down to some nitty gritties about some of the issues, which is so prominent to us all, and so important. So, I'd like to thank you for taking part on the show this evening, and hope you come back in the very near future as well. Please do.
I'd be glad to.
As I say, it's been an absolutely awesome night tonight with yourself. As I say, this Sunday, as I say, we got Elizabeth Savinich Wolf our next guest on the show for Sunday. But I'd like to thank everybody who's been listening out there in the radio world. And, of course, everybody in the chat room. It's been very quite busy in the chat. There's been some great links going up. Everybody's been very, very busy. So once again, thank you all, Team EDL. God bless you all. But as I say, would you like to just say a few closing words before we close up the show, guys? Baron, maybe
well,
you?
It's hard for me to have. It's hard for me to just have a few words, really. I guess it would be this. It would be this. The most pernicious component of most of what we've talked about, the three of us in today's show, is the problem and the fact of selective enforcement of bad laws. So the government comes along and says, well, we're going to make it illegal for people to say, to say something which may invoke hatred in a listener towards a specific group. Well, that can be sold to a general complacent public pretty easily. Yeah, sure. Yeah, you shouldn't let people make other people hate people. That's bad. Everybody's okay. Let's, you know, why can't we all get along? Well, the problem is it's never enforced across the board. If it was, it would still be bad, but it would be considerably less bad. You know what happens. They enforce that law against the people they can enforce it against, and they do not enforce it against the people they cannot. So you're going to end up with government-sponsored mosques to the tune of, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. I'm sure that's a lowball figure. All across Europe and the UK, certainly, you've got these mosques which are nothing more than, as Gavin Bobby says, they're a hate crime in a building form, and they're never being charged with the kinds of crimes that we know take place, even after major TV shows like Hidden Mosque 1 and Hidden Mosque 2 and Hidden Mosque in Sweden came out, and hidden mosques from across Europe, shows got made where they were basically picking the main, most prestigious mosques in different cities and countries, and they were exposing the kinds of constant rabid hate speech that came from them. I mean, I'm talking about incitement to genocide. And no charges laid. But again, if an EDL EDL person says something in the forest where nobody can hear him, is he still guilty of a hate crime? You bet, he's in jail now. So that's my last words for Friday, the 17th.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, Vlad. It's mind-provoking thoughts. Thank you so much, and I'll give you the last thought of the night there, Baron Bodisi. That's good. Thank you so much for being a guest tonight.
I just rather than talk any more about the things we've been talking about, I want to, since I've got at least a largely English audience, I'd like to send you my greetings. I lived in England when I was young for 4 years. I did my O levels and A levels in Yorkshire at a grammar school. I remember it. I call it the England that was, and it's largely gone now, but I remember it, and that's one of the reasons why I'm doing what I do. So my greetings go out to England and the English, and especially
Thank
Yorkshire,
you so
which
much.
Is the real Englisher in Yorkshire. The rest of you are bloody foreigners.
Well, once again, Baron Bodisi of the Gates of Vienna, God bless you, brother, and I hope we'll be speaking to you in the future on future shows. It's been absolutely awesome tonight. And once again, to you, Vlad Tepet, once again, thank you so much for being a great co-host this evening, and we're going to do it all again this Sunday, aren't we? It's going
to
be another great show.
Don't forget to visit gatesofvienna.net, and, you know, drop a couple bucks in the tin cup if you can. gatesofvienna.net for all the great work they do. See you guys Sunday. I'll sign off.
Thank you very much there. Thank you, Vlad, for that. Okay, so, ladies and gentlemen, we're now coming to the end of the night. I'm going to say to you all, thank you so much for tuning in to East Anglia's EDL radio show, the official English Defence League's radio station. To all the guests sitting in the chat room this evening, and of course, not forgetting you, our great listening audience. So thank you so much. Please take care, stay safe, and no surrender ever, guys. And guess what? We're going underground with about 90 seconds left. Good night, guys.
People might say my life is in a rut. Quite happy with what I got. People might say that I should strive for more. But I'm so happy I can't see the point. Things happening here today. A show of strength with your boys brigade. I'm so happy and you're so fine. You want more money, of course, and of mine. My New Zealand friends was for Tommy's friends. And the public gets what the public wants. But I want nothing.
Again, I went over a little bit of time, but I hope if you're listening in the archives that you've enjoyed the show tonight. It's been a great honour and privilege to, as I say, to have Baron Badisi and, of course, a great Vlad Tepes. It's been absolutely an awesome night tonight. So as I hope you all enjoyed it. And as I say, we'll be back again this Sunday. We've got Elizabeth Savadich Wolf on, and she's got she's a very interesting lady, guys. She certainly is. And as I say, we'll be having a little chat with Elizabeth this Sunday. So please stay tuned to the East Anglians EDL Radio Show, the official English Defence League's radio station. I'm not going to be here too long this evening, guys. I'm just going to... Do you know what I was going to do? Let me see. There was something that I got lined up. And I've got so many things in my drop-down box now. But I was going to play a little tune, if I can find it. But no, as I say, it's been absolutely an awesome night tonight. What can I say? It was just fascinating. Sometimes you might have heard, but I might have gone a little bit quiet because it was so intriguing to hear Vlad and the Baron speaking about some of the serious issues which we discuss on the radio show all the time. So I hope you found it as interesting as what I myself and many others did. So I was going to thank you so much for tuning in tonight. I'm going to play this tune, and I haven't played it for a little while. It's Alex and the Bandits, and this is Road to Damascus. I just love this tune. I hope you do as well, guys. Here we go.
I found a freedom on the open road to Damascus. Oh wait,
the lion!
Done some bird, a penitentiary for nerds, and on
we
there you go. As I say, that was Road to Damascus. I hope you enjoyed that, guys. That was by Alex and the Bandits. I just love that tune. Do you know what I'm going to do, though, guys? I'm going to leave you with something I played last night. It's a little bit different what I normally do, but I'll say goodnight to you now. I'm going to play this and so you can digest, you know, what this was so stirring. Most of us listen to it to put the hairs on the back of our necks up, so I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. And as I say, we'll be back again this Saturday. Well, before I do that, I was going to play the jingle. Let's see if I can find my jingle. Where's my jingle gone? I can't find where I've got my jingle now. Never mind. I'll play it Sunday. I'm going to play this. It's the last thing I'm going to do, play for this evening. And once again, we'll be back again this Sunday with Elizabeth Slavodich Wolf. And I know you're going to enjoy listening to what Elizabeth has got to say. So, and of course, that'll be with our co-host once again, the great Vlad Tepes, his great blog as well. So, with that, I'm going to play this, guys. Thought provoking. And I'm going to end this after I finish this. So good night, guys. Take care. Stay safe. God bless you all. Not forgetting, there's no surrender. No surrender ever. Okay.
There is a class war being fought on the streets of Britain today. And just as in the general strike of the 1920s, where violence erupted onto Britain's streets, a similar situation is taking place today. Once again, the war is between the poor working class people of Britain, who are suffering in so many ways because of the policies and the decisions made by the middle classes and by Britain's ruling elite. In the 1920s, the ruling elite were the aristocracy, the hereditary peers and the gentry. Today, our ruling elite are the privileged political classes, politicians from the Labour Party, the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats, who, like others before them, see the working class people of Britain as the lowest of the low, the people whose living standards, culture and quality of life mean nothing and can be manipulated, controlled and crushed in order to benefit the lives of the privileged political and middle classes of Britain. The consequences of the ruling elite and the middle classes' policies of mass Muslim immigration into the UK can be seen in working class areas of towns and cities across the country. The Muslim terrorist plots, paedophile gangs, homophobic attacks, Muslim patrols, Sharia law courts, attacks against women, and the mosques, hate preachers, and Muslim no-go zones can all be found in working-class areas of Britain, but never in the quiet, leafy suburbs where the middle classes live. The effects of all the problems that the middle classes have caused are never felt by the middle classes, but they are destroying the lives of the working-class people of Britain. The champagne socialists of the Labour Party and the Liberal Left have shown complete and utter disregard for the working class people in this country, and a political party that was formed to represent the working class is now completely and utterly deaf to their concerns. And worse still, they actually attack them when they speak out about what is happening. Not only are the instruments of the state, the police and the courts, being used to crush and silence anyone from protesting about what is happening to the lives of the working class, but the unofficial representatives of the middle classes are also used to intimidate and stop anyone from speaking out. Groups such as the UAF, which is mostly made up of middle class people from middle class areas with little or no Muslim population, are none of the problems that the working class people see on a daily basis. People who never go to working class areas, people who have never tried to walk through a Muslim no-go zone and have never experienced any of the problems that their ideas and policies have created, They do not feel like strangers in their own country. They do not feel threatened, alienated, and live in fear. Their daughters have not been raped by Muslim paedophile gangs. Their children are not afraid to walk down certain streets in our towns and our cities. They have not seen their culture and their way of life gradually disappear, to be replaced by something that is totally alien and aggressive towards them. But the working class people of this country have seen all these things. The ranks of the UAF are also swelled by people who have made a good living from the ruling elite and the middle class's policies. The social workers, the community cohesion officers, local councillors, MPs, the interfaith leaders, but never by the working class people whose lives have been turned upside down. Groups such as the UAF, which is backed and funded by politicians from all three main parties, are used to try and silence the working class people and to put fear into and intimidate anyone who tries to speak out about the injustices they see. The English Defence League is made up of working class people from working class areas. It is made up of the people who have suffered at first hand the effects of our political elite and the middle class's decisions and have to suffer the consequences of them again and again on a daily basis. And yet the English Defence League are slandered and attacked by the media, lied about, abused and victimized, just as the working class men and women of the general strike were when they tried to speak out about what was happening to them. They're pelted with bottles and bricks, spat at and attacked for simply telling the truth about what is happening to their lives, their children's lives, their culture and their communities. The working class people of Britain really have bore the brunt and suffered the most from Muslim extremism, because the political elite have housed those extremists on working class streets and in working class communities, and they expect the people there to simply shut up and suffer the violence, persecution, intimidation and fear, while the middle classes stay as far away from all this as possible. But all the while they try and silence anyone who speaks out. But the English Defence League will not be silenced. We will not simply go away. You can attack us, lie about us, and imprison us, but we are never going to be silent. Our way of life is more important to us than your greed. Our way of life, the way of life of our fathers and our grandfathers, is not yours to manipulate, change, and destroy. We will always speak the truth about what we see happening around us and the suffering it is causing. The English Defence League are never going to go away. We are only going to get stronger and stronger, because unlike you, our lives and the lives of our children depend on this. And no matter what you do, we are never going to surrender to you, to Islam, or to anybody else.
And that is the way. We will never surrender to these people out there who want to change the whole way of the future. We're the English Defence League. We're not going nowhere. Try what you may, we won't go anywhere. We'll continue to tell the truth, whether you like it or not. And if our enemies out there is listening, we're not going away. So forget it. We're here for good. And as I said, we're going in strength and strength. So, you know, that's the way it is. So good night. Take care. Stay safe, guys. And we'll see you again Sunday. Thank you all for listening to the archives. I hope you've enjoyed the archive as much as what we did on the main part of the show this evening. But I've got a very busy Skype box going this moment in time. Good night, guys. We'll see you again Sunday. I hope you've enjoyed the show this evening. Good night, guys.